time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Here in Fabinaugh, Oklahoma. We'll be leaving tomorrow to go to Gauss, Texas to Float Fest. We're just winding up mid-fest here. Still got some dinners and things to do and people to see. And, you know, it's Ben, we've been spending a lot of time playing with aircrete, building domes. That turned out way better than I thought this material. We'll keep you up on that. But today, right now, we're going to be talking to Pastor Chuck Baldwin. Now, Pastor Baldwin and I go back to 08, you know, during the Ron Paul Lovelution days and his campaign for Presidente of the United States of America, you know, as the Constitutional Party candidate that, by the way, was endorsed by Ron Paul. Ah, everybody's looking for that. Well, Pastor Chuck Baldwin got it. Now, he moved his congregation from Florida. And what would you say, Pastor Baldwin, when you move, a pastor moves and he takes his flock or his congregation or his ministry up to somewhere else? What do you call that move? A trek? You know, what is that?
Well, we didn't actually take the congregation with us. As it turned out, there were a handful of families that did. Follow us up here to Montana, but the vast majority of the congregation, of course, did not. So, but it was my entire family, all of the adults, five heads of household, 17 people in all. We all made the journey.
Well, that's all you need, because boom, man, it started all over again. Here we've been. Donna and I visited Kalispell, Montana, once to, you know, hang out with them up there and see what's up. And we're going, wow, this is awesome. It's beautiful and great people. Ah, but it's still too cold in June. Never mind. But, you know, so Donna, man, she's digging the desert. She's had enough of her snow and kid in Pennsylvania. Now, the reason that I wanted to have Pastor Baldwin on, yeah, there's so much news and stuff going on that, I mean, there's plenty to talk about. But what got my interest was it was a sermon that you were giving probably about 3 weeks ago. Don and I, you know, Sunday morning, we're doing our, you know, get to heaven due diligence kind of thing. And we're watching Pastor Baldwin, and you were talking about, I don't know if you remember this, you know what I'm going to talk about, here it comes. You were just railing on the intrusiveness of government agencies and departments and shiny badges with clipboards and their fine hat always backed up by the, you know, available gun, that they, I sensed a sense of frustration that in a free country like America, that you felt that you were being oppressed by hordes of the king's men harassing and eating out our substance. So I wanted you to tell us the story behind the story. You got me going. I'm like, oh, I got to hear the rest of the story from Pastor Chuck Baldwin. Tell me what's up, man.
Okay, I'm pretty sure I remember what you're specifically referring to. And I was using that as an illustration to show how the encroachment of overreach by especially the federal government, but sometimes state officials as well, is you know, literally strangling us. And the freedoms that we once had, and those of us that have lived long enough I'd say if we are 50 years of age or older, we can remember a much calmer, much more peaceful and unobtrusive time in this country when we really were able to enjoy the fruits of freedom. And those days have slowly been taken away from us. So the illustration I was using on that day was, and this goes back to shortly after my father passed away. He passed away in 1993 at the age of 86. And it probably would have been, let me think a minute. It might have been 96, 97, somewhere in that time frame. Anyway, you know, when you're young and you're just trying to get started in life, it's really difficult to keep your head above water. And, you know, you're borrowing money for this, you're borrowing money for that. You know, you got credit cards and, you know, the whole nine yards. And unfortunately, we had to do that in the younger days. And it was a struggle. I mean, we started our church in Florida from scratch. We had six people our first service. We didn't know anybody. We had no money, no property. I was fresh out of Bible school. And, you know, so literally it was claw and struggle the whole way. So anyway, so I remember my dad was old school. You know, he went through the Depression. He went through both world wars, actually. And that generation of men and women, they were frugal like nobody in this generation could ever comprehend. They knew what it was like to not be able to have food on the table and to be able to buy a new pair of blue jeans or whatever. They were very, very, very frugal. We never wasted food in our family. There was no, so my mom would make enough meal to begin of the week when I was growing up. And, you know, if you didn't like it, didn't matter, because that's what all you were going to get for the week. And you either ate it or you didn't eat at all. And so the idea of credit and borrowing money was virtually anathema to my dad. The only thing that I know of that he borrowed money, he may have borrowed money when I was a kid, I didn't know, but the only thing that I know that he borrowed money for was his house. If he couldn't afford it with cash, he wouldn't buy it. He just couldn't afford it. That was his philosophy. So everything he bought with cash. So he lived a very modest life, but he lived the life that he could afford, and he didn't go into debt. And I watched him as he paid cash for virtually everything. He either wrote a check or he paid cash, depending on what it was. And that kind of stuck with me when I was growing up and when I got grown and married and, you know, and I'm crawling and scratching and all this stuff. I always remembered, I always thought how great it would be to be able to buy a vehicle with cash. And I mean, I've never been able to do that. So after Dad passed away, I had a modest inheritance from my father, and I paid off bills and credit cards and things like that. And I had just a little bit of money left over. And I thought, you know, there's this used pickup truck down there that I would really like. It's a full-size, half-ton pickup truck. I had a Chevy S10 at the time. And so I'm going to do this. So I sold the Chevy S10, and I went down to the car dealership, and I paid $10,000 cash for this half-ton pickup. And that didn't quite cover it. I did have to write a check for the balance. But anyway, I had $10,000 cash. That was the big thing. And I felt, wow, this is so wonderful to be able to go down and buy a substantial item like a vehicle and put cash on it. And, you know, I was nostalgic, and I was thinking about Dad and thinking about how, you know, that's such a better lifestyle as far as I was concerned that he had than what we had with all the borrowing and all that kind of stuff. And plus, I felt really good about it. So I did. I bought it, got the truck home in the driveway. Ernie, it wasn't more than a few days later. I remember it was on a Wednesday, And I remember that because we were getting ready to go to prayer meeting, my family and I. And so the knock at the door. I go to the door. And there was a little weasel of a guy. And he flashes me his badge. And he's an IRS criminal investigator. And I'm not making a word of this up. Every word is true.
What city is this?
A criminal. This was in Pensacola, Florida.
Okay.
It wouldn't matter, though, where you were.
Yeah.
The IRS don't care what state you live in. So he says, first thing, what is this? You know, you question, your mind doesn't comprehend what this is all about. So then he says to me, he said, Mr. Baldwin, you bought, I think it was a 1995 GMC half-ton pickup truck. Did you not? I looked at him and I said, what kind of a dumb question is that? I said, you know I did. I said, your car is parked right behind the truck in the driveway. So then he goes on, very, very curt, very impolite, you know, authoritarian.
How old is he?
Probably late 30s.
So he's tasted enough authoritied and playing the game.
He was arrogant to beat the band. And so finally, after a few preliminary questions like that, he said, okay, Mr. Baldwin, here's my question. I want to know, where did you get the cash? I literally felt the hair stand on the back of my neck.
And what was the emotion? It was, kiss my butt, or is it fear, or what?
No, there was no emotion. On his part, there was no emotion.
No, on your part. I mean, the hair on the back of your neck was anger, or was it?
I was anger. It was anger. Anger. I told him, I told him flat out, I said, I put my thumb and my forefinger together, and I said, I'm this close to throwing you out of my house.
Oh, he was in your house?
Yeah. Well, at first he asked if he could come in. And at first I hesitated, and then I did let him come in. So he was in the house. And I was so angry. I told him, I'm ready to throw you out of my house. And then I had enough calmness to say, but I know if I did, you'd make my life hell on earth. And so I said, this is the most intrusive act of big government I have ever heard of or experienced in my life. I said, how dare you? You have no right to ask me this question. This is none of your business. And so forth, and I spouted off for a while, and it didn't faze him. He came right back whenever I finished with, where did you get the cash? He wasn't going to leave without an answer of some sort. So either I had to throw him out, refuse to answer, or I had to answer his question. So this was just amazing to me. So I went ahead, and I told him the story. I said, okay, look. Sold the S10 for $5,000. My dad passed away a couple years ago, left me a small inheritance. I had some cash. I used the money from the S10. I used the money from the inheritance. I went down. I paid that much money for it. I said, that's how I got the money. So then I thought, so that's it. That's over. I told him the truth. That's what happened. So he gets up and ready to leave after a little bit more conversation. The whole conversation was probably 10, 12 minutes. And he reaches into his pocket and hands me a subpoena to appear at a grand jury. Yeah, I laugh now. Yeah, I mean, this is all because I partially paid, or a truck, a used truck, that wasn't even a new truck, with a modicum of cash.
So this is 1995, you're thinking? around then?
1997, probably, 1997.
Okay, what was going on then? We got Clinton's in the White House, you know, got to go get, you know, Christian white men with money. Because I remember 97 was Oklahoma City bombing, you know, around then. It was because it started off with Ruby Ridge and Waco and all that happened as the mid-90s. And then by 95, 97, you know, Oklahoma City bombing was at least, I think it was 2-3 years on the day. You know, April, oh, yeah, well, what month, probably doesn't matter. But I'm going, yeah, there's this overreach where the IRS under Clinton administration and the FBI files and everything was being weaponized. And you were part of the moral majority or something like that, or your ties as a young man with the church was, you know, starting when politics started to devolve into political. Or before, in the late 70s, early 80s, it was kind of aversion to politics. Were you politically active at all? Were you on the radar screen?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was on the radar screen.
Well, there's your answer.
Let me give you a little backdrop on that. So I started my radio talk show in 1994. And by 1997... my talk show, and this is not being braggadocious, this is just a cold, hard fact, was the most influential, not only radio talk show, but probably influential medium, period, in the entire Florida panhandle for the cause of constitutional government, Christian values, et cetera. I mean, my program was the program. We helped elect 2 U.S. congressmen. We helped elect, I don't know how many county commissioners and city councilmen and school board members.
And how far facts from your mind when he's there doing this?
You know, I wasn't even thinking about that.
Are we thinking about it now?
Well, yeah, but I mean, so here's the thing. Here's the thing that's interesting about that. I mean, so you're asking about the involvement. So here's the interesting part of that. Which I didn't talk about this in my message on Sunday because I didn't even think about it. But you're bringing this out, so I'm remembering things. So it was interesting that, this is when I got to the grand jury. So when I got to the grand jury, a lot of stuff in between, I talked to my lawyer, blah, blah, blah. You know, I did a lot of stuff to make sure that, you know, I wasn't walking into a trap and all that kind of thing. And so I had a lot of legal counsel.
Yeah, you're always walking
before
into a trap.
Before I went any further, yeah. So, but anyway, so I got to the grand jury, and one of the first questions the little weasel asked me on the stand was what I did for a living. And I told him I was pastor of the church. And he stopped, and he was surprised. And he said, oh, I thought you were a radio talk show host. He did not even know I was a pastor. That caught him off guard. And I told him, I said, yeah, I'm a radio talk show host as well. I said, that's my avocation. I said, my vocation is I'm a pastor and have been for 18 years or whatever it was at that time. And I said, but that's, I have a radio talk show on the side. But he was not even aware. It wasn't even on his radar that I was a pastor. But he knew that I was a radio talk show host. So that, I thought, was extremely interesting.
So it wasn't his own personal investigation, anything that he was doing. He just had a card in his inbox, and he's following through if somebody told him to do something.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah, those guys aren't doing anything on their own. No. He didn't know who I was from the man in the moon. He was just following orders.
A grand jury from some kind of large investigation of all talk show hosts of whatever? Is this actually a grand jury convened for you?
No, I don't think it was convened for me. My attorney, after the initial visit at the house and the subpoena was handed to me, I went to my attorney's office, of course, the next day, and he got on the phone with the IRS agent in charge of the district and started talking you know, very detailed questions about the case and why was I being subpoenaed and blah, blah, blah. And my attorney told me that he thinks that the target of the investigation was the finance manager at the truck dealership. Mm. That they were looking at people who were paying cash, and the target was probably the business manager. But and he told me, he said the attorney told, who, by the way, the attorney used to be an IRS investigator, so he had a tremendous amount of background in that area. And he said I promise you they will find nothing. He said this is a fishing expedition. They do this all the time. And he said they're hoping, you know, they bring guys like you in to pay cash, and though you're not the primary target, they're hoping that maybe if somebody's dishonest or whatever, they'll find it, and then they'll find something else on the other end as well. So they're fishing. They're in a fishing pond, and they're trying to find somebody that did something wrong based upon the distribution of cash. So that's the whole point to me that just drove me crazy and still does to this day. In fact, you know as well as I do, Ernie, if you make a cash transaction at a bank of more than what, $2,000 or $3,000, you're going to be reported to the Internal Revenue Service. I mean, any major transaction, if you buy anything with cash these days, you're going to be reported to the IRS. And you could get a visit just like I did at any time. I mean, this is how intrusive, and we're not even talking now about the
what's going on now,
emails and our texts, and you know the electronic end of it wasn't even thought about back in those days, but this is still very much a part of this police state that we're living under. And if they follow through with the collapse of the dollar, like it looks like is going to happen, and the introduction of the digital currency, then they're going to try to wipe out cash altogether, and that's their goal. That's their ultimate goal.
Okay, I want to talk about
the point is.
I'm sorry. I want to talk about that. You know, we'll get to that. But there are two things I wanted to mention. I made a note to myself here while you were talking. Is, you know, one, I just saw, it'll go up later today on Freedom's Phoenix, that, advocate for disabled people, whatever, long story, but the bottom line was this. He goes, you are at a disadvantage, and it violates, how they word disability, and blah, 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 blah. When you're talking to a police officer, they, by case law, I remember when this happened, are allowed to lie. You're not, they are. That puts you on at a disability in dealing with government, to where they're encouraged to lie to trick you while you are penalized if you don't tell the truth. And I'm going, yeah, that's a big reason why not to talk to cops. I don't talk to police because you lie. Yeah, you're allowed to lie. You're encouraged to lie to trick us into something. So I thought that was of interest when you're talking. I'm going, yeah, you got to be careful because they'll lie, you know, and they're protected. Where other agencies or government employees or people, you know, there's the liability or even criminal activity for fraud and, whatever. You know, fraud and threat of fraud and force and all this kind of thing, threaten you with whatever. They're insulated from any liability from what their lies cause. In fact, they can prosecute you, send you to jail, based on how they would trick you with deceit. So I'm going, okay. Then this builds up to where they revel in this, and to the point that they personify evil. I want to talk about good and evil, definitions of that too, for how I want the conversation to go. But the one thing that I remember, I was in Phoenix in the mid-late 90s, about the same time, and there was an off-ramp on the road, and I go to the stoplight, I'm going to make a left or whatever, and in front of me was a mounted police officer and a motorcycle officer. And the little chrome thing around the license plate, because I guess they have license plates, and around the license plate it said, smile, I could be behind you. And that just pissed me off, because I remember as a kid, you know, waving out the back of the window of my parents' or my grandparents' car. You know, waving at the officer. They wave back, officer-friendly kind of. You know, that was the atmosphere that I was raised, growing up as a little kid in the mid-60s. Now, of course, around me, God knows what was going on. But as a kid, you know, what the hell I know. So I watch, the Andy Griffith Show. I mean, you know. So when they did that, it just, as I became, I'm an adult, and I'm just like in my 30s, I think, I was just pissed off that they would, that I called the precinct, wanted to talk to whoever's in charge, lieutenant, sergeant of whatever. And I told them this, so I said, look, I just want to share this because it really pissed me off that, why should I, be worried that he was behind me? You know, he's sitting there articulating exactly that I should be afraid if he's behind me. I should be happy that he's in front of me, because if he was behind me, what kind of message is this? And of course, nothing happens and nothing. Okay, I just wanted to express myself. But this attitude of these guys doing these sweeping investigations, just throwing it out there, and they're able to lie, just I don't see where this has a good ending. And as we're going into what's happening now, who do you report bad guys to? Are these the bad guys, good guys? And then we can talk about how we define good and bad. And I'd like to do that if you could help me out. I mean, I'm talking to Pastor Chuck Baldwin. So I need kind of the definition. Well, evil, what do you know is evil? Evil's subjective. Truth is subjective. We know the truth. What's the truth? Who gets to say the truth? Well, first thing I go, well, it's not lies. I mean, it's not inaccurate information. We know the truth. It's we don't know the lies. I mean, even if we do, that we're not espousing them. So I need for you to help me out with that. Evil, what is evil? Well, it doesn't have a lot to do with good, So then you got to define good for people and so on. So help us out as we're talking to these other subjects and the stuff around us, that you have this government reveling in their evil, in their ability to lie, and that you should feel bad when they're behind you. Well, who are these people? They're not good. So let's talk about the essence of good and evil to further our conversation. Will you help me out, Pastor Baldwin?
Yeah, sure. But before I do it, you brought up a topic that I think I can really be of help to your your viewers and listeners at this point. My youngest son, as you know, is a constitutional attorney. And, of course, he and I have collaborated on a couple of books, Romans 13, The True Meaning of Submission, and then To Keep or Not to Keep, Why Christians Should Not Give Up Their Guns. But he also made a presentation at Liberty Fellowship here in Kalispell a couple of years ago, in which he articulated the do's and don'ts about police contact. And we have that on DVD. It's police contact and what to do and not to do. And he speaks from an attorney point of view, a legal perspective. And it was extremely helpful to me, and I think I probably knew a little bit more than the average person about that subject. But whenever he finished, I realized that I had a lot more to learn, and this would be very helpful to know how to communicate when you are brought in contact with a police officer, whether it's a traffic stop, or whether it's meeting one on the street corner, or an accident some nearby, or any time a police officer speaks to you and questions you, what do you say, what do you not say, and to know your constitutional rights as a citizen of this country, and to know when to not say anything at all, and if you do talk, what you should not say, and things that you can say and should say. Very, very, very helpful. If every freedom-minded American would watch that video and take notes and remember the things that he covers, and whenever you are brought into contact with a police officer, most of whom I think are decent guys, it will really help you to know to not get yourself in trouble, because that all that stuff about, you know, what you just said, they can lie and you can't, and anything you say, they will hold it against you, and all that. It's very, very true. So it's very helpful. You know, a lot of the people on our side, the freedom-oriented guys, they make trouble for themselves because they don't know the law. They often just get themselves into trouble, and you could avoid a lot of this stuff if you just knew how to conduct yourself in the presence of a police officer. So I'd just like to put that in as a commercial, if you want to call it that, and just let your listeners and viewers know that that is available on our website. My son, Tim Baldwin, police contact. I can't remember the subtitle, how to respond or something like that.
So we got your webpage into the archive. You go to the day's archive for the show, April 27th, 2022, Pastor Chuck Baldwin, and you have all the contact information, websites in there. They can go and attain it there. So what the okay. – because I remember your book on Romans 13, you know, we need to have this – what that's about, you know, for the audience is that you abide by the authority that God's given the local municipality of blah, 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 blah. And then he does a good explanation of what that really means. But it's also people need to know that the Bible was assembled. The Council of Nicaea, it was a Roman thing of you can't beat them, join them, or take them over or whatever. And you find that there was an editing session. There was a censorship session in the assemblage of the Bible, you know, by people and whatever interest they have to put stuff in or out. And that one passage has been a great controversy, you know, everywhere. Anytime you cover that, or you do it certainly in politics, you have a bunch of Christian libertarians that want to examine that. Well, Pastor Baldwin did. And, you know, so you want to skip to the end on that so people know correct everything that I said wrong. And, you know, that what your argument is.
Well, yeah, the book Romans 13 is right now out of print, Ernie. We've sold that completely out. We still have the ebook available. People can get the ebook, and I have condensed the book into four messages that we have on a DVD. So you can still get the ebook, or you can get the four messages that I delivered, which I used Romans 13 as the text, and I brought four messages on the salient issues contained therein. Yeah, the point is that the evangelical leaders over the last 70 years or so, especially since Scofield Bible came out, have used Romans 13 as a predicate for total submission to government. And that's why most of your evangelical churches today are really worthless in terms of resisting the forces of evil. It's because they've been taught this always obey the government, no matter what doctrine from Romans chapter 13, which is not what Romans 13 is saying. And the thing about the book and the messages is that, you know, we didn't use just Romans 13 because Paul wasn't saying anything new in Romans 13. I mean, this was a doctrine that was taught as far back as the Old Testament scripture. And he was elucidating, but he was not introducing something new. And so we went back into the Old Testament. We go into the New Testament passages as well. So we cover the entire spectrum of scripture, not just the New Testament, not just the book of Romans, but the entire Bible. And we show the biblical teaching relative to authority. And here's the bottom line that people don't understand. Christians, I'm talking about, and that is that under God, all human authority is jurisdictional. Only God Almighty and His Son Jesus Christ—they're the only ultimate authority in the universe. That they are the highest powers. There is no appeal beyond their authority. So every authority under God is a jurisdictional authority. God has given certain statutes and requirements relative to authority, I'm talking about human authority, based upon their responsibility. And the jurisdiction of that responsibility is what is key. For an example, what do you say? Well, a governor in a state has certain jurisdictional authority relative to his office, but he does not have dictatorial authority. He's not all powerful. He cannot violate the constraints of his constitutional slash jurisdictional authority. He cannot tell a father how to raise his children. He cannot tell a pastor how to conduct the affairs of his church. He can't tell the business owner how to conduct his business, et cetera, et cetera. This is jurisdictional. A pastor in a church has jurisdictional authority as overseer under God in the church, but he cannot dictate to the husband or to the mother of children how to raise their kids. He cannot dictate to the employer how to run his business. So I'm saying every office has jurisdictional authority. And the problem is that Christians have taken Romans 13 and they've applied it to a divine standard. In other words, they've applied human government, the authority of human government, which in the United States is a very, very broad and very dissected realm of authority. We're not a monarchy. We don't have a king in this country. At least that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And we have federal, we have state, we have county, we have city. You know, you have judiciary, you have legislative, you have executive. You know, all of these are designed by the founders to be checks and balances on government itself, so that the power of government cannot accrue into one particular office or one particular jurisdiction. That was the design of our government, and it was a brilliant design. There's nothing wrong with the design. The problem is that evil men just continue to, you know, disobey and violate the restrictions of their jurisdiction, and they begin to expand and overreach that which they do not have. But the jurisdictional authority is the key, and whenever you say to a congregation that you should always obey the policeman, you should always obey the governor, you should always obey, you know, whatever the legal office is, no matter what, no questions asked. Well, what you have done is you have ascribed deity to that person, because they're the only power and authority that demands all obedience, and there is no hesitation, there is no question, and that is God Almighty. God Almighty is the supreme law of the universe.
So the Christians are targeted and opposed mostly because they are questioners of authority. You know, this is why I've seen since my adult life, there's been, because, you know, I got married in the, you know, mid 80s, having children, they're starting school in the early 90s. All of a sudden, here comes the Clinton administration. You start paying attention, watching news and everything. And it's like, you know, especially with Waco, the biggest sin that they had, they were Christians. They believed in a second coming. They're a target. They need to go after. And you're making a case that, you know, you answer to a higher authority. Well, damn it, there's no higher authority than I'm a presidente of America and, you know, whatever. So I can see that,
well, that's true.
You know, your teachings and being a pastor and certainly, you know, being a talk show host, that they're going, yeah, he answers to a higher authority and there's nothing higher than my shiny badge and the whatever. But when I saw you get animated, you know, like Pastor Chuck does on Sunday, and I got the feeling that there was a fresh recurrence of shiny badges in your life. Now, I wanted to drill down on that. You got anything cooking now?
No.
Come on. I felt it, man.
nothing along the lines of what we're discussing. Let me just say, though, that you're exactly right, because there are many in government, not everyone, thank God, but there are many in government that do have a God complex. They really do. They do believe that they are the highest authority. And that is the fault, in my opinion, that is the fault of the pastors and the churches, televangelists of the country, who have given them this false authority. through Romans 13, they have got up on television, radio, and the pulpit, and they have kept telling everybody, you know, obey the higher authority, obey the higher authority, you know, obey, 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 obey. And so the policemen themselves and the you know, the people in government, they have been given this idea from the pulpits. Well, you know what? Yeah, you don't have a right to question me. I have authority over your life, and you have to obey me. And I had a pope put a crown on my head. This has developed over half a century. This didn't used to be this way. Like you talked about back in the 60s. I grew up in the 60s, and you're exactly right about the attitude toward the policeman. My dad taught me that policemen were my friend. The sheriff, the longtime sheriff of my county, was a personal friend of our family. And we had a great deal of respect for the sheriff's office and the deputies. We knew many of the deputies, you know, by name. We knew the city policeman. You know, it was a small town. It was, you know, we didn't fear a police officer, and there was none of this bullying stuff going on back in those days. I mean, if you had trouble, they would stop and help you, and they weren't fishing for stuff. They weren't trying to find something on you. You know, they really were on the side of the squad car said to protect and to serve.
Well, they took that down. They don't have that anymore.
That's what they wanted to do. Yeah. But so that was the attitude. But, you know, over 50, 60 years of this false preaching by the churches about Romans 13 has given a false view in the minds of the authority as to their authority. I mean, you keep telling a guy long enough that everybody must submit to him. Everybody must submit to him. And you are the authority and nobody can resist you. And you say that loud enough and long enough over a period of 50 or 60 years, and you're going to get a generation of policemen, and not just policemen, but other government officials that have the idea that they are the law.
And that starts at police academy. I was at the age, you know, in church I had, you know, several Bible study members, you know, over the years that they go into police academy and they beat that into their head, you know, and they become, you could see them change as they get a us-them mentality. You know, it's by design. You know, but now we've gotten into where you're beaten into this, respect the authority of, you know, man. You know, that's, you know, you got issues right there. But it's evolved into, you know, like the Tony Fauci worship kind of thing. I'm like, wow, that's the A game? That's the best they got? This is their champion? You know, this is their Goliath? This is it? You know, I'm going, well, this isn't going to last forever, you know, and of course, you know, that's going, but there's a resurrection. There's, I can see in the minds or even articles I think we have on Freedom's Phoenix today about the left and Democrats and so on finding God. You know, they're starting to, you know, seek out religion for answers more now. They're starting to go more traditional. They're starting to, you know, the churches are rising up. And in Phoenix, you know, there's my daughter and son-in-law's, my oldest daughter, her family go, and we went and visited. And they never took off the mask. They never, you know, shut down. They never, you know, bite me. We're going to do it. And they are bigger than ever. And a lot of support going that way. What is your witness of that? You know, there is an abandonment of whatever promises the government has made, and they're starting to seek God again. Is that your experience?
Yeah, my experience is that over the last few years especially, the message of Liberty Fellowship has resonated in the hearts of thousands of people. Our followers are now international. And we have satellite fellowship groups numbering, I think, over 200 the last time I counted, around mostly the United States, but also some foreign countries as well. People that have been, I think, so disenfranchised from the establishment church and the message of, you know, worship the establishment, that they're looking for truth. They're looking for somebody that will speak the truth. And over the last 3 years, especially, Liberty Fellowship's outreach has grown exponentially. Man, I'm here to tell you, Ernie, that our audience now is many, many fold more than it was 3 years ago. And I think that's because the greater the pressure is from a would-be dictatorial government upon the citizenry, the more people began to look for the voices of freedom. And at least that's been my experience at Liberty Fellowship. And I'm going to have to leave you here in about a minute or two, but I do see that awakening taking place.
Well, I'm glad you're out there, you know, giving it what for, you know, and helping define this. This is one thing I would, you know, it's not like we don't promote, you know, all your writings and stuff on Freedom's Phoenix anyway, but I would definitely like to see the book, or the sermon at least, of Pastor Chuck Baldwin on defining good and evil. You talked about, you mentioned the Schofield Bible or something. I'm familiar with that. Schofield, is that what it was? I'm familiar with that project. That was all the seminaries, all the training for pastors got this Bible that had somebody else's the commentary on each of the passages and everything is bigger than the Bible itself. I mean, you know, it's just this enormous, like, teacher's book kind of, you know, thing. But it's manipulation into a certain way of thinking, and Israel, you know. So it's, that is a whole subject I'd like to get into too, but the we'll do that next time. But the actual
let's do a show on that.
You know, definition. Yeah, you know, we did help to produce the movie. You know, that came out of Phoenix. What was it? The Bible, and that was like a big thing. So, you know, that's a whole other topic. We passed a lot of those out. But the main thing, good and evil. If I get you to define, because I can say truth, what's truth? It's subjective truth. Well, it's not lies. But when you say, well, you know, what's evil? Define evil. Well, it's not good. Well, define good. You know, so now that's a little bit, you know, more subjective, or you would think it wouldn't be, you know, and that's why I need Pastor Baldwin to help me out with, you know, the definition of good and evil.
Yeah. Hey, Ernie, can we save that for the next?
Yeah. No, you got a homework assignment.
Okay. Hey, no problem.
Thanks for coming on, Pastor. It's always good to talk to you, man.
It's great talking to you, and I thank God for what you're doing, Ernie. Thank you very much.
You bet. Peace, brother. Bye.